Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 567. And I'm joined today by John Bradley. Oh, this was a lovely conversation. So as we discuss, John's been on twice, but only one of them was in person. And both of the previous ones have been part of like a press junket. And we've kept in touch. Like we'd met a little bit before the first one and we'd hit it off. And we've met, you know, a couple of times outside of this, but yeah, this was the first time we got to sit down and have a really kind of get into it type. Do you know what I mean? Like we discuss it, it's a different vibe. You know, originally I didn't do many press junkets and I do them now. And, you know, I generally think the vibe still works and is good, but it can be slightly different. So it was great to get John in the Acast studio and just sit down with no one else present, just have a good old natter. John was in one of my favourite shows of all time, Game of Thrones, and is in another favourite show of mine, one of my shows of the year, Three Body Problem on Netflix, one of the biggest shows in the world right now. So we get into all of that, but we get into a load of other things along the way. You know how these conversations work. We start with the art, and then that generally ends up informing, you know, the personal, the internal. Am I talking nonsense? I don't think so, but it sounds like it. I'll give you that. It sure sounds like it, but I don't think I am. We're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Don't skip, don't skip. Oh, you're really going to want to skip now. So I was reading an article and I've been talking to friends and I've been seeing it myself. There's been a rise in transphobic, homophobic, anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, generally racist and horrible graffiti in the past few years. And I'm not talking like big amazing works of art that happen to be horrible. I'm talking scrawls on walls just saying horrible stuff. I know we've kind of always had that, like if you want sex call Barry on this number or Sarah's a slag, that kind of thing. But it's just there's a lot of nastiness because a lot of people are angry and nasty. So I've made some sticker packs that are just nice. And there's 9 in a pack and they're free. All you have to do is pay the postage. So I'm making a loss on this. But the idea is you get one of these sticker packs. I think I'm going to try and limit it. I think we've got it limited to one per person because we can't have anyone taking the piss. But just have one of these sticker packs in your pocket, in your bag, in your coat, wherever, in your bum bag, if that's how you choose to live your life. And then you just, if you see something horrible, you just pop a nice sticker over it. And there you go. You've taken something horrible out of the world and you're spreading just a bit of positivity and niceness. Yeah. So they're over at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Ways that you can support me without bankrupting me include patreon.com/ScroobiusPip, where you can donate or chip in. Not donate. You can have access to extra posts. It's nothing exciting over there. I ain't going to lie to you. It is essentially a donation each month and that helps out the podcast. Or you can head to twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio where you can watch for free, but then you have the option to subscribe to get all sorts of benefits. So loads of good stuff. That's enough of the nonsense. Let's get on with this. I would recommend you go and listen to the first two times John has been on, but then I would also say that this was my favourite by some way. I would rank them this one, then the first one, then the second one. So maybe listen to them completely out of order in that way. Yeah, you know, it's a choice. It's an option. You might be looking at your podcast app and going, ah, there's no podcasts have come out today. Buxton's on a bit of a break, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, you could just go through all three. You could have a real Pip and John Bradley day. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 567 with John Bradley. Right, I'm here today once again with John Bradley. How are you?
I'm really good, mate. Nice to see you again.
And you, we were just saying it's weird because this is your third time on the podcast.
That's right.
But one over Zoom, it doesn't feel like it counts really because we didn't get to actually see each other and chat before and after. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly,
you're in the Zoom, you have the chat and then you're gone. Whereas even the walk up the stairs here, it's been nice to have a hug, have a catch up.
Yeah, totally. I think the last time we spoke, that was part of a junket day that I was doing.
Yeah.
So even that feels like a kind of different atmosphere.
Yeah, because it was in a hotel in
I was in the Savoy, I think.
Yeah.
I was in.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, that's, even that, it's a lovely chat, as it always is with you, but it's even that's still got a different energy to it, because you feel that's a part of your day and you've got a very hard out and you've been talking, you've been talking all day. So it kind of takes a bit of that casual vibe out of it when it's just part of that day. But this is how it should be done.
I completely agree. I'm going to give a quick shout out to Acast as well, because we're in their studios.
Yeah,
it's
their
10th birthday. And I love having chats in here, man, because it is a studio, but it doesn't feel studio-y and promo-y.
It doesn't feel
formal.
Impersonal.
It feels really relaxed.
Yeah, exactly.
And they just leave me to it.
Yeah.
more often than not, I'm letting myself in and out.
Going,
all right, I've definitely had guests on who I don't know well, who kind of assume it's my studio. I'm like, think that all you like. I'm happy to have you think I've got a studio in East London.
But there's just such a lovely vibe to this type of building where it's facilitating conversations like this.
My only concern is, because it's in Shoreditch, I linger out the front just for when my guests arrive. And if it's a guest I don't know that well, I'm like, they might walk up to about five different people thinking it's me, because it's very much the look of the area. So I should almost have a name tag. But I mean, how have you been, man? And how are you finding it all? Like we were just saying, it's been a hectic start to the year because you're in this huge show. And last time we spoke, and a few times like we've messaged privately, you were just kind of getting going on Three Body Problem. And Benedict Wong's also a pal, and I've messaged him a little bit about it. And we'll get into it more, but it just felt like an exciting project from the start, and that doesn't seem to have stopped as it's come into the public domain as such.
No, exactly. Well, I think that's the thing about it, really, that when we last spoke, which was like summer of 22, I think.
Yeah.
We've been shooting it for about 9 months then.
That's mad.
And now we're April 24, and it's just been out a month.
Yeah.
And I think more than any project that I've been involved in, it feels like such a very long time that it's been in the future.
Yeah.
You know I mean, like we started it, we shot it, it was all in the future. And then that the period in between where we were doing other stuff, but they were doing the post-production on it. And we knew it was going to, it had been put back a few times. It was going to be November.
Yeah.
Then it was going to be January. Then it was going to be March. All of that all seemed in the future and something to look forward to. And now for the first time, it's in the past and it's out.
Yeah.
And after having such an intensive relationship with something for that long, to actually get it out in front of people, even though it's been 3 years nearly since we started it,
yeah,
it still felt like we're not that. Same with any art form or piece of entertainment that you produce, that big thing of kicking it out into the world and seeing how it does. You're never quite ready for it, no matter how long it's been.
I can completely see, and you're right. It's mad to know that you'd been filming it for that long at that point, but it feels like a project that it was. Like a long experience. It feels like from talking to you and to Benny and others, it feels like everyone really bonded. Like it's maybe the first TV show you've done since Thrones that was this kind of extended, you're all bonding together, you're all part of this gang, rather than sometimes film projects can be beautiful for the 2 weeks you're there.
Yeah,
and then you're on to the next thing. And that doesn't make it any less wonderful, but it's not the same as this extended, this is, particularly as in the length it's taken to come out, this has been the biggest thing in a lot of our lives.
Yeah,
For 3 years or whatever.
Whilst
we've done other stuff too.
Exactly. And I think that because it's quite similar to Thrones in a way, in so much as there are lots of different elements to it and not everybody's involved in every part of it. Like there's flashbacks to, you know, the Cultural Revolution in China. There's stuff within the sort of VR video game element of it. And so it's not like a kind of normal procedural drama where the characters are kind of, it feels disparate a bit like Thrones was. But even despite that,
it feels like there's groups.
There's little teams.
Here's the group that are doing this bit, which was what Thrones was, wasn't
exactly
it?
Exactly
like
the
you've
same.
Got your island group, you've got your...
Totally, yeah, exactly the same. And I think that the thing that you have to get your head around when you're on a set like that or you're dealing with such an enormous group of people is it really gives you an indication of what it's like to be a showrunner.
Yeah.
or you know, be a writer on something like that. Particularly David and Dan, and they brought another guy on, Alex Wu, to help to showrun Three Body Problem with them. It's a bit like, we come in, we do our bit, and then we disappear.
Yeah.
Tomorrow you look on the call sheet and you see, oh, they're doing a flashback sequence to China in the 1960s. That's nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
But to them, all of this stuff, they care about all
it's
of this stuff.
Important.
All of this stuff as much.
It's,
and just to hold that in your mind, have the mental capacity and stamina to just have your mind across all of that stuff for what was 18 months.
It's what I love about these projects and being... Since, because I guess the first time we spoke, I probably wasn't acting at that point. So having moved into that, it's what I love about these projects is witnessing how important. I mean, I bang on about casting directors a lot, and a lot of my mates take the piss because they think I'm just trying to get work. But like, it makes you realise how important the casting is, and not just for on screen, but the project itself.
Yeah.
And I think the key to things like that is David and Daniel and whomever else, because there's loads of people that are running things.
Yeah.
They have to be all over everything, but they can manage that when they have faith in you being all over your character and your scenes and Benny and whomever else, knowing that they're all over it until they put people in these roles. And then there's a little bit there that they don't have to be quite as... Like, they're still over it, but they don't have to be quite... Like, a lot more can be put into that.
Yeah.
Because they've put the right person in that role who is going to go, right, well, this is my job now. All the nuances and intricacies are on me now.
Exactly. And that's when it becomes a real collaborative effort, not just in terms of actors and writers and directors, not just in terms of that circle, but across the entire crew when it comes to, you know... When action is called on a take, that's not just action for the actors, that's action for absolutely everyone.
Yeah.
There's action for the camera,
yeah.
People are on hair and makeup, they're watching the monitors to see if everything's okay with their thing. It's across the whole... And for a long time, I was quite... I don't know how you felt when you first started doing it, but I was quite... I thought if a take went wrong and it was my fault, it was just the end of the world.
Yeah.
And they were all judging me and they thought I couldn't do it. And it took me a long time to kind of get over that until you realise that there are hundreds of elements for every take, and any one of them could go wrong.
Yeah.
But a costume could go wrong, somebody's hair could fall down, the camera could be in the wrong thing. And when that happens, everyone just goes, okay, fine, we'll have another go at it.
Yeah. And you don't hold that anger if someone else messes up.
Completely.
So why are you putting that on yourself?
Yeah, completely. It's just, but all of these moving parts have to be doing the right thing at the right time. And if that doesn't happen for whatever reason, it's fine because, you know, you could mess up this time. It'd be somebody else's turn next time.
Yeah.
And that's when you take a bit of the pressure off yourself and just realise everybody is there to support everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there's a difference between just being in front of the camera and behind the camera. If you're facing that way and everybody else is facing this way, it feels like there's a separation there. And the sooner you realise that there isn't at all, that's when you start to become more of an organic process.
It's good for you in every way to realise that.
Yeah.
Because it also stops you having the ego of this is all about me. It's
exactly.
Realising it isn't all about you. Again, I think it's made me a lot more or a lot less openly critical if I don't enjoy a show or a film or something, because you realise there's so many things that have to go right. Moose Rokwonga, great writer and journalist. In one of his books about football, he wrote about how England fans in particular really fail to realise how much has to go right to win a World Cup.
Oh, God,
like these players, all the stuff that has had to go right in the previous league seasons for these players, then their preparation, then this, then that, then this. It's like there's a sense of entitlement almost of, we should win. It's like, no, it's so hard to win.
Oh,
there's so much has to go right. And I think of that when I am on film sets now, that you're like, wow, for this to turn out good, so many things have to go right.
And oh, completely.
It's why I'm extra excited when they do. And to be clear to our listeners, this podcast is us having a catch-up. It's not specifically about Three Body Problem, but I don't know if I'm going to get anything else in because I loved it and there's so much I want to talk about.
Yeah,
so
there's kind a lot of, to talk about.
It's kind of an unintentional... And I want to kind of keep as spoiler-free as possible, but I think you're completely right. And I was really lucky because the first time I was ever on a set, it was a Guy Ritchie film and Charlie Hunnam was in the lead. It was King Arthur and it was all on a mountaintop or in up Snowdon with a helicopter shot, all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they messed up loads and just reset. And that made me go, oh, so that's just okay. Like, imagine if that had been me messing up and it's, okay, send the helicopter back. Okay, all the horses... back in position. But there was points on that first scene where they were like, and Guy Ritchie directing was like, I don't know if that dialogue's working. Like, let's try something else.
Yeah.
So it had that relaxed nature, which made me really early on go, all right, if it goes wrong, it goes wrong. That's the beauty of this versus what I used to do on stage.
Yeah.
Whereas if it goes wrong, there's no hiding from it.
Yes,
it's
exactly.
It's like, all right, we've got a level of comfort here. But
yeah. I remember once I was on Game, it was very early on in Game of Thrones. I think it might have been even my first or second day on it. And on that show, we had big resets because there was lots of background and lots of set dressing that needed to be exactly right. So the resets could sometimes take, you know, 15, 20 minutes in between takes sometimes. Yeah. And I remember being very nervous because I haven't, you know, I think we've spoken about before, I didn't do any camera stuff. I didn't quite know what I was doing for the first part of that shooting that season. And I remember walking back to my place to start again, about reset, and I went back to my opening mark. And I heard the assistant director ask a background actor what he was doing in the take. He went, what are you doing over there? And he was messing about with his bucket, and he went, oh, I'm just pretending to fill this bucket with water. And I was a bit like, oh, we're all just pretending to do stuff.
Yeah.
You can talk about acting in very kind of highfalutin ways.
Yeah.
Basically, he's pretending to fill that bucket of water.
Yeah.
I'm pretending to be Samwell Tarly. I'm not really.
Yeah.
I'm pretending all of this stuff's really happened to me. And as soon as you get a sense of it, it's just a bunch of people pretending to do stuff to entertain people.
Yeah.
It demystifies it. And you're just a bit like, well, you know, the stakes suddenly become a lot lower
in quite a
liberating way when you are mindful of something like that.
I love those moments of realization. Like, I had a moment just realizing that what we're trying to do is present as close to truth as possible.
Yeah.
Like, we want you to believe what this is. It is lies because it's all written, but we want to get as close to truth as possible
from
our own connections. And it's what has made me obsessed with all the roles I've played. I've never had a stammer, and I've got a stammer in real life, but I've never had a stammer. And I had this real breakthrough of this thing of kind of being not ashamed of my stammer, but knowing it's not right for everything, like on stage and so on and so forth, trying to get it under control and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm now obsessed with getting a character that stammers because it is uncontrollable and it is the rawest truth. So
yeah,
this hunt for truth constantly.
Yeah.
It's like I've got a few scripts in development where I say at the start for the character that I'm playing, this character has a stammer. It's not going to be scripted. It's going to present naturally. Because I've seen badly written scripts that have a stammer as well.
I can
it's like,
it, yeah.
You need to stammer at this point. Like, that's not where I would...
Totally.
That's not how it works.
Yeah,
so the excitement of that, of realising, oh, that could be something out of my control.
Yeah.
And then in a way, realising all the things out of your control take the pressure off a bit. Because as you say, there's so many things out of your control in every take.
Yeah.
Not just on every set, in every single take. So I don't know. I find that really liberating.
It's very liberating. And it's, talking about three-body problem, it's probably the most liberated I've ever been when it comes to acting because I was playing a character that was written for me and based on me.
Beautiful.
Which is a really strange... It's really strange thing to be confronted with that.
That's so cool though, man. That's such a leap of faith and an affirmation of your ability, who you are.
I'd like to think so, yeah. But it's just like, you know, when you get a sense of... It's the same as you're saying with, you know, taking the control of your thing and your world and your experience. It's a bit like I then felt much more capable of adding, you know, collaborating in things or having an opinion on this character more than I kind of ever would before. And it's kind of difficult to argue with if a character is based on you and you have an opinion.
Yeah.
It's kind of difficult for them to argue with it. So I sort of you just bring everything that you have in your entire life experience to this role, no matter what the role is. I've often said that acting, no matter what the character is, it's basically doing a remix on yourself.
Yeah, completely.
Because everybody's got everything within them. So you just do a remix where, I'll that side of myself that's not useful for this character, I'll pull back and this character, I'll push forward a bit. So I think all of that, like all the best and most truthful actors are truthful because they're not guessing anything.
Yeah, yeah.
They're, even if it's 1 second of their life where they've been in so much of a rage that they could kill somebody.
Yeah.
Even if that's just 1 second, they embed that into their psyche and they can contact it.
Yeah, completely. And you can turn these things up and make certain things more of a deal breaker than they would be in your day-to-day life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So then that becomes your character's personality. It's like, no, I don't waver on this. Whereas in real life, you're like, yeah, I'll take it or leave it.
Yeah, but, totally.
You know, that can really, yeah, that's fascinating. But so how have you found the huge promo side of it? Because as we were saying, it has been international. It has been...
Yeah,
the glasses things I've seen at different like Comic Cons and just all sorts of cool stuff like that.
Yeah,
what's the balance of excitement and exhaustion in that world? How's that balance?
It's very finely balanced, and yeah. At various points I've kind of slipped down the other side of it. But I think the unique thing about this show is the fact that very rarely, for various reasons, but very rarely does a first season of something have such a huge attention on it.
Yeah.
We didn't really have that with Game of Thrones.
No.
Because they were fans of the book, but nobody had heard of David and Dan before. Yeah. It was just HBO doing this fantasy thing and everybody was like, oh, let's see how it gets on. And we didn't even really get big on that show until maybe season 3 or 4.
Yeah.
The first two were kind of under the radar, but this feels like because it's David and Dan's next thing,
mm-hmm.
there's an enormous amount of expectation on it that they never had before going into a new thing. And I think just getting a sense of that where people are already have an opinion about this before it's even out there.
Yeah.
And you know, people are very...
Because it was talked about for a while as kind of unfilmable. It's been this series of books that are adored, but kind of talked about as it's very complex and, you know.
Exactly. So I mean, we had that on Game of Thrones as well in terms of book fans who were very passionate and very kind
of
militant about it. And if something's not right, they'll kick off about it.
They really will.
But
they really did.
But they really did, yeah. But this is a whole new level of expectation because, you know, how is that followed?
Yeah.
And the thing about David and Dan that you have to admire in them is they've not taken it easy on themselves when it comes to their next thing.
Yeah.
In terms of the, you know, the reaction to the end of Game of Thrones and the various opinions that were being thrown around, I think that they could have easily been forgiven for taking something a bit more straightforward or, you know, an adaptation that isn't quite as, got so much scope to it and isn't quite as complex and quite as demanding. But they've kind of picked an even more on, like, more unfilmable and more complex source material for this thing.
Yeah, truly.
And as soon as you do that, you're setting yourself up for a fall in a way, but I think that if they pulled it off all the way along, it was going to be like a huge moment in TV, recent TV history, I think.
They're a bit big, haven't they?
Yeah,
and
completely.
It's paid off. How did you, I mean, speaking of the kind of complexity of it, how did you find that for taking in the script and the source material and all that? Because there's a thing now that studio execs and commissioners will talk about, and it's about whether something is second screen enough.
Right.
And it means, like, I've heard of stuff that they've been asked to kind of simplify the script a bit because it'd be hard to follow if you're looking at your phone.
Yeah.
Because so much, and again, that kind of annoys me, but also I know I've done it myself for shows, so I get it as well. So, and Three Body Problem went in the complete opposite direction to that. It was not second, like, they didn't, like, you have to pay attention.
Yeah.
You can't be browsing on your phone as you're watching because it's so intricate. So how was that to kind of take in on your part? I was going to say, did you just kind of accept that, well, I don't need to understand all of it, but then your character is a fucking genius, essentially. So you kind of had to go as deep as you can.
That was exactly the thing. I tried to read up, and knowing that, I think we all knew that, kind of pointless in a way because you're never going to know enough about it.
No,
I'm
going to become
exactly
a genius or some kind of scientist as research.
But that was the key into it for me. I read like a book about it, or tried it, basically just looking at it. I looked at a book about it and read it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I sort of realised that it was useful because I think, oh, my character, Jack Rooney, would understand this.
Mm.
And that sort of lets you know how would somebody who comes from a working class background in Manchester like me, how would a character from that background who could do all this in his sleep, how would that make him see the world?
Yeah.
And how would that make him feel to be in really rarefied company where people from that background don't normally get there?
Yeah.
What that would
do. And have it almost come easy.
Have it almost come completely easy. And you know, what does that do to how he sees the world? Goes around the world with an incredible sense of confidence and a sense of ease in himself. And the way he interacts with the world, he's got a very easy rapport with the world and people around him, because he's a fucking genius, naturally instinctive genius.
Yeah.
And I think that, even though I didn't understand the physics side of it, it led me to understanding his attitude to life and himself really clearly.
I love the idea of you get in the book and trying to read it and then thinking about, man, how good would it feel if I could read and understand, like to find the character, even find your limitations to go, oh, I'm ending the day going, oh man, this is too much for me.
Yeah.
Imagine not.
Exactly. You know,
as simple as that.
Yeah,
imagine
exactly
not.
That. And imagine, you know, defying all the odds in terms of what, I mean, I think that's kind of something that, when we're talking about truth and how you extract your own truth, that was something from my truth about, you know, one of the things that we most have in common, me and this character, is that we have come from a background and ended up doing something that people from our background don't really do.
Mm. Yeah,
we've kind of exceeded completely our expectations of ourselves, and we've exceeded the limitations that a sort of prejudiced society would put on somebody from that background.
Yeah.
And we've both kind of, gone above and beyond anything that we'd expect from our own lives growing up. And that was a really sort of interesting thing to contact. But I think the thing about telly is, as opposed to, and movies, but as opposed to novels, when it comes to the science of it and all of that stuff, making telly is a balancing act between how much you've got to say and how much time you've got to say it in.
Mm.
And we could, there's a 30 episode, very faithful Chinese adaptation of Three Body Problem.
Right.
And it's 30 hours long, and you know, it goes into all the kind of detail of the book. But we knew that we didn't want to do that. We wanted to make an 8 episode, very, very sort of intensive blast through this source material and make it fun and make it accessible.
Yeah.
So all of that, that's a very different demand on it in terms of how much of the physics we could put in and how much we could get across to the audience. And just expediently whip through this story, some things have to be removed and some things have to be changed. But I think when it comes to the genius of an adaptation like this, it is in what you leave out.
And what
you think, oh, we haven't got time to go into that, but we'll allude to it in this line of dialogue.
I think they did really good in kind of almost showing the audience that they don't understand this. So these guys do. Do you know what I mean?
Kind of
have a bit that goes, well, it's this. So we can kind of go, all right, well, spoon feed it to me then. Yeah. Rather than just going straight to that, it had elements of that, you know, it's kind of, you can kind of go, well, a physicist might actually understand that, but I need it spoon fed. I accept that.
Yeah, completely. And I think one thing about it, which is a huge sort of feather in its cap when it comes to the audience that it was going after, in the same way that Game of Thrones was going beyond a fantasy audience and into they can put fantasy into the mainstream.
We sort of
wanted this to be more than a sci-fi drama, because it is a sci-fi drama, but it's also a love story, it's a detective story, it's a political story.
Yeah.
And I think that because our show starts in the real world, it's a heavy sci-fi thing, but it doesn't start in space.
No.
Or it doesn't start like something like Dune, which is, you know, 10,000 years in the future or whatever. Because it starts in the real world as we see it out of our window and then goes crazy.
Mm.
I think that's an easier way in for people.
Yeah, completely.
And makes people who don't necessarily aren't a heavy sci-fi people, it gives them something to latch onto, recognisable characters that they can latch onto, and then the stakes get massive and then the circumstances get huge for these characters. It's a way of making people invest in it slightly and taking them out of their comfort zone by putting them immediately in their comfort zone and then showing the characters going out of their comfort zone.
And that's exactly it. I think there's something really beautiful about the way the story is told. And having not read the books, I assume it's from the books, but it may be in the way the adaptation has been taken on. But it kind of, the way the VR stuff's done and all this kind of thing, it reminds us that there's loads in our life that we don't understand but accept.
Yeah.
Our mobile phones are a prime example. It's I don't understand any of it, but I accept all, like, I use it every day, probably more than I should do. I don't know how any of it works, but we accept it. And that's kind of the beauty of this. There's loads of tech stuff that comes in that you kind of go, it doesn't feel like a crazy leap.
Yeah.
Because you're going, yeah, all right, that's, you can't do that now, but okay, I can see.
Totally.
10 years ago, I wouldn't have thought that we'd be able to do half the things that we can do now, so.
Totally, but like, I think what the show does great as well is it draws parallels between the absolutely huge and the very small. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about a first contact with life from another planet or whatever, and yet you have a character in it who is, this is not too much of a spoiler, but you have a character who's facing a very personal sense of mortality. Mm-hmm. It's not about the Earth being destroyed by aliens. It's about, why should I care about the Earth being destroyed by aliens in 6 months if I've got 4 months to live?
Yeah, exactly.
It's all, you know, that thing you say about there's so much stuff that we don't understand about our phones and stuff. We also don't understand why our own heart keeps beating.
No.
You know what I mean? But they're just things that you just have to accept are happening, and you just have to live your life as you possibly can. And another thing that's great about the show, I should say, is that it shows that if the circumstances are huge, it doesn't mean that the personal things go away.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that people stop falling in love. It doesn't mean that people stop saying funny things.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that friendships don't still go through those things. In fact, when it comes to huge circumstances, those things are even put under the microscope even more because you know you're running out of time.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that sense of humanity within a story with so much scope to it, I think that's what sort of separates the good sci-fi from great sci-fi.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the mix of, again, I think just the way it looks at mortality in general is the characters in there who have, as you say, like 6 months to live versus the ones who have been told that these aliens are going to kill us all in however many hundred years.
Yeah.
Versus the ones who could die in, again, that was the whole Game of Thrones thing, was anyone could die at any moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Really interesting to have that element, but also have levels along the way.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, you're not going to die in a minute, you're going to die at this point,
yeah,
and
completely.
You're going to die at this point. It's like, oh, wow, that really changes the way everyone acts.
And when we consider that you know, this, you know, in however many billions of years, the sun's going to burn out and this planet's not going to exist anymore, it kind of makes you stop worrying about stuff.
Yeah.
Because you're a bit like, well, I could try and stay alive forever, but nobody is.
And anyone who's shaking their head, the prime example is the state the planet's in now.
Yeah.
Because for generations, we've kind of gone, nah, it's going to be next generation's problem.
Yeah.
And then it starts to become ours. We're like, ah.
Yes,
can
I know.
Can we resolve this now?
Yeah.
Because again, it's that simple thing. And so you could easily say, oh, if I knew, I'd still care about the next generation. It's like, but historically, people have kind of just gone, oh, that's ages away.
Yeah.
I like having my car or flying everywhere or whatever else it may be.
Or some people just don't believe it at all.
Yeah.
Which seems like a, well, you may as well believe it just in case.
Yeah.
And try and do something about it just in case. Yeah. What if it is? Yeah. You're not really stupid.
Yeah.
If the thing that you've been denying is happening actually happens.
Imagine if, just to make a point, you've committed the world to an early end just because you're like, well, I'm not into all that.
Yeah,
all
right. Exactly.
No, you're not, but it's not that hard. But, well, I mean, one thing I wanted to talk about, when you were saying about how we're just a month or so after it coming out, how's that been? Because Game of Thrones was one of the last, I'd say, global series that people are tuning in every week.
Yeah.
And then the next one, and then the next one. So this is kind of the first big thing you will have done, that you've had 3 years of all building up to it, and then it comes out, and there's all this excitement, but then it is kind of on to the next one.
Completely.
As such, it is kind of, oh, what do we binge next?
Yeah.
How's that?
It's
I haven't experienced the other, where it was Monday morning or Tuesday morning or wherever it worked out, time zones, everyone's talking about it. Game of Thrones, again, was one of the last things I remember such anger over any spoilers on social media.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's like, no, at least give us this amount of time to watch it and all that. Whereas this is a different way things are consumed now.
Yeah, completely. And you do find that, whether it balances out, I don't know, but you do burn incredibly brightly for not as long.
Yeah.
And the conversation's very, very intense with something that has... I mean, I was talking to my friend Rose Cartwright, who wrote episode 2, and she's also a great... She's an amazing author. She wrote Pure.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen it, the book about OCD. And she's been very, very happy to have her on, very grateful to have her on. And we were talking about... Because she's been writing on it since day one.
Yeah.
David and Dan first heard about the project, or first got attached to the project, in 2019.
Wow.
And it was just come out.
Yeah.
And you know, the disproportionate thing between how long it takes to make, and then suddenly everyone's talking about it for a couple of weeks. And we were just saying, does it feel sort of over already?
Yeah.
And we'd be like, it does actually. We feel it's like, mad, we feel it? Like we're really kind of past the peak of it. But it's just a model of how, you know, the insatiable appetite for telly. Netflix have got a new thing. When we came out, it was Ripley and now it's Baby Reindeer.
Yeah.
That's just on Netflix.
Well, it's,
that's not even on television in general.
It's doing it in my head in at the moment because I really want to watch Baby Reindeer, but yeah. I've got three things I'm getting through. It's Ripley, Fallout and Shogun, and I don't want to start a fourth. So yeah. It's like I need to finish one of them before I can start the next run because, again, I hate the fact that, I'm really enjoying something and then, as I said, also because of spoilers, you don't really get to talk about it at all.
Totally.
So you really enjoy it privately.
Yeah.
And then you move on to the next thing. It's the whole, if a tree falls, and no one's there to see it.
Completely.
And because, doesn't make a sound.
And because of that, if you want to watch, because things burn incredibly brightly for not very long and you've got a few weeks and then people are talking about something else, if you want to be part of the conversation, you have to latch onto it at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the glorious things about consuming anything, building communities around talking about it. And I think, you know, social media does have its failings, but one great thing about it is if you have a certain emotional response to something that you've watched, you can share that with other people and then it becomes like a conversation.
Yeah.
But with something like Game of Thrones or recently Succession, which is their final season, was something that I watched episodically and the first thing I've ever stayed up late to watch at 2 o'clock in the morning. You had quite a long time to join that conversation.
Yeah.
Now, if you've not joined it within a couple of weeks, the conversation's stale.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a bit like watching when Big Brother first came out.
Yeah.
And literally, it was on every night. And if you didn't see the night befores, you were just completely out of the conversation. You couldn't be talking about what happened on Tuesday, on Thursday, because that conversation's over. Everybody's...
And the arcs of those characters was the fastest. Like, no one would write it like that. You'll start the week loving a character. Midweek, you hate them.
Yeah.
End of the week, you're back in love with them.
Exactly.
That's what reality TV does.
Completely. So everybody's trying to be part of whatever the current stage of the conversation that is. And because of that, it means that people know that they've got a shelf life to have that conversation before that whatever show they're talking about is replaced.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing in a way because it shows that people, even in, you know, people talk about you used to watch telly on a telly or you used to watch films at the cinema and now you just watch them on your phone.
Yeah.
It's kind of encouraging that people are still watching it, not necessarily in a vacuum, but they are still trying to
engage.
Share their opinion. Yeah, but the way that they engage with other people about it, it's changed. They're not talking about it with people at work necessarily or people in their living room. They're going on Twitter to talk about it.
Yeah.
But that just means that you've got a very finite amount of time to do that in before you're just talking about something that nobody else is talking about anymore.
I've definitely nagged and been nagged to get something watched because I've got a mate who wants to talk about it. Succession's a prime example of that.
Yeah.
But if I couldn't watch it the day it came out, I'd have my brother, my mate Natasha, a few others been like, have you watched it yet? Because we really need to, like... thankfully I've got mates who are really good at not giving any kind of spoilers.
Yeah.
They won't say, oh, it's a big one, or your mind's, do you know what I mean? Because then you're prepared. So, but yeah, there would be that pressure to get it watched and get it.
Yeah, but I think, that's lovely.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important function that all entertainment plays. And so it's not just how going from episodic weekly to streaming, what that's like to experience it. It's all the peripheral stuff around that. That changes the entire dynamic of the culture when it's like the peripheral conversations around it and how those conversations are had. Everything gets changed as soon as the format changes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's bizarre. How's this project been for you and for your mental health, your professional mental health? Because I remember when we were talking in 2016, it was kind of, there was excitement and nerves because, as you've touched upon before, like Game of Thrones was kind of the first thing you'd done. As you just said, you didn't know about screen acting for about two or three series.
All, yeah.
So it's kind of a big thing. And I'm sure there will be, even if it's a quiet voice in your head, a wonder if you've lucked out, you've peaked on your first ever job or all these other things. And you've done a load of other things I want to touch upon as well. But this feels like the first thing to really make you be able to confidently go, nah, this is another huge show. this is because of me. It's not just I happened to get this role on this show that no one knew would be the biggest show of all time.
Yeah.
I've got this role because of me. They wrote it with me in mind, kind of thing. Has that been good for you as for yourself?
Definitely has, yeah. Especially when, you know, you think about Game of Thrones we shot the first season of it 2010.
Mm.
And, you know, in the past few weeks when people have come up and recognized me and spoken to me about it, I still expect it to be Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Because that's basically what people have talked to me about for all those years. But now if they're in their 20s, it's more likely to be Three Body Problem now.
Yeah.
Because it's out and it's having its moment and everybody's watching it.
Yeah.
And I do find that when people talk to me about Game of Thrones, I'm still very flattered and I'm still very proud of it. And I, you know, the way I have that interaction hasn't really changed. But when it's something else, when it's anything else, it just means an awful lot more in the moment. Because
it's me with a song of ours called Thou Shalt Always Kill.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's like, that's the one that will still come up a lot. But anytime any other, and it's lovely still.
Yeah.
Anytime any, because for me, there's songs I'm far more proud of.
Yeah.
So anytime one of them comes up, it means that bit more.
Yeah.
Rather, and again, it's still nice. And I completely can see how it's not like you're saying, oh, they're banging on about Game of Thrones.
No.
That's still amazing.
Yeah.
But I can completely connect. It hits more when it's like, oh, that one.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
It just feels slightly more like it just feels like the less obvious thing to talk about.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, Three Body Problem's a big show and lots of people are watching it. It just feels like I'm just a completely different person as well, and getting to show a side of my personality that's very different to the character that I'm most widely known for. It gives me just because if you are a certain type of character, or your character is a certain type of persona, if that's all you're known as, people will approach you like that.
Yeah,
and they will think, oh, he's quite nervy, or he's quite nice, or he's quite sort of meek.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how you're perceived by the world. But if you play a character that isn't like that, that is confident and all the things we've said, comfortable with himself and very self-assured, it just kind of rounds you out a bit more.
You get to be you now.
Yeah.
You get to be you, and people are recognising you as you rather than that one character. I always remember, this is going to sound like a weird one, but I always remember Will Smith saying one of the best things he ever did was getting his character in The Fresh Prince called Will.
Yeah.
So people knew Will.
Yeah.
And then it transferred over. Whereas Carlton.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Everyone thinks of Carlton.
Yeah.
That's not his name. That's not, he's done other stuff, but that's all you think of him as, because that's Carlton. And Will was like, he's adamant that, obviously he's done a lot of different things, but that was one of the things that made him able to be recognisable outside of that.
Yeah.
Because
that's really interesting.
The same name.
Yeah.
Whereas, as I said, you think of Carlton as Carlton.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that, regardless of what else he's done. Carlton is Carlton.
I was saying that recently, that when we touched upon this the last time we spoke about, there are very few actors that can get by without brackets after their name.
Yeah.
In terms of, nobody would say Robert De Niro, brackets, Godfather Part 2.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, Goodfellas.
Taxi Driver.
All that stuff, yeah. But I think there are very few people that can kind of get there.
Yeah.
But even if you do one other thing that a larger number of people want to talk to you about, It just feel that you've sort of cast something off,
yeah.
And I think what's happened now is this is an interesting thing that I found, that Dan Weiss and David Benioff, they said that they wrote this character for me because they knew, as we were filming Game of Thrones, that I was nothing like that character at all.
Yeah,
Dan said that I'm the real me is almost diametrically opposed to the character that I was playing.
Yeah.
So they wrote me this so I can play a character that's a bit closer to myself and show different sides of myself, which is a very generous thing for them to do.
It's beautiful.
But it feels a bit now like people think that Sam was really me and that this is a transformative acting role.
Yeah.
Because like people...
That was the first introduction.
Exactly.
So people think,
oh, he's really adopting this character of this quiet sign, the kind of confident...
Yeah.
Smart ass, kind of a little bit dickish, but people don't realise that I'm doing sort of less acting than ever.
Yeah,
but because it's a new thing, they think they can see the work going on to it. Where instead of putting stuff on, I've been taking stuff away.
I love it. Me and Tim Key have a bit of a game where I think of shows that he wasn't in, but that you'd believe it if someone said he was. Like the easy one is Ghosts.
Yeah,
Tim Key's probably in Ghosts.
Yeah.
I've kind of now transferred that game over to Three Body Problem, because of the VR world or alternative reality bits were just awash with amazing, iconic British comedy actors.
Oh, absolutely,
Mark Gatiss, Reese Shearsmith, Phil Wang.
Yeah.
But then I'm sitting there going, was Kevin Eldon in there? I think Kevin Eldon was
in there.
Was Mark Heap in there? Mark Heap
probably so
was. Was Mark Heap in? Was Lolly Adefope in there? I'd imagine so.
That's
but
so
again,
true, yeah.
I, it's now, I can now remember, all. You give me almost any comedy actor, British comedy actor, I go, yeah, I think they were in the China bit, weren't they? Were they in that bit?
Yeah.
So it's thrown off its own weird little game.
Yeah.
How cool was that to kind of... Obviously, I want to talk about the core kind of team because it feels like you made a beautiful family there, but how cool was that I think they did really good in just casting these small roles, these really distinct, iconic kind of characters?
Yeah, well, I think that mainly came from our showrunner Alex Wu, who was True Blood, did this kind of his big kind of success before this.
He, what a show.
Oh, amazing show. And he's an amazing mind as well. And he's in the same way that you do get some American people, especially in LA, who are just British comedy obsessives.
Yeah.
You're amazed at the things that they know about because they kind of absorb it in the way that people here who are into like Japanese comic art.
Yeah,
the way that they obsess about that because it's something out of your culture that you just immerse yourself in. So they're all my heroes as well.
Yeah,
because that's very much my kind of sensibility is you know the getting to be on a set doing scenes with Mark and Reese.
Yeah, it's mad.
Like in Steve Pemberton's place, it's a bit like the Beatles saying Ringo's off.
Yeah,
do you want to come in? Just step in and just getting to see a sense of their... It was like I'd won a competition because they're shorthand between each other. They've known each other their whole lives. And just getting to listen to the way they interact and the way they make each other laugh. It was literally like being a sort of fly on the wall, being a fly on the exact wall that I'd want to be a fly on.
Yeah.
In terms of... And but like Phil was awesome. I love working with Phil.
Yeah.
But the big one for me in the show, which people kind of... It's kind of slipped under the radar that Adrian Edmondson's in it.
Yeah.
And he is my ultimate.
In a key role. It's the only reason he wasn't on the list was because it wasn't kind of in a cameo bit. It was a key...
Actually, a key thing, yeah. He wasn't quite as stunty as the rest of them.
Yeah.
But he just came on and I wasn't in scenes with him, but I met him and I sort of got to speak to him about... Basically Rick... Him and Rick were the reason I wanted to be an actor in the first place.
Yeah.
Because I saw them, you know, when I was very young and just remember laughing so much and thinking, I'd love to make other people feel like this.
So
for him to be on a show that I'm on and I get to say that kind of stuff to him, it was just awesome. But that's the thing about having a show that is this, it's got so much scope to it. You can have Adrian Edmondson in a show with Asa Gonzalez.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Benedict Wong and Giovanna Depo and it makes
Benedict Wong should be in there on because again him in 15 Stories is one of my just favorite comedy series ever and he's done so much dramatic stuff since that it gets overlooked but I'd put him in there with as I said you Mark Heaps you Kevin Eldon
completely
I did a BBC series with Aid Edmondson. Never met him, never had a scene with him, but that was the name I mentioned any time I was telling anyone about the show. It's like, it's got Adrian Edmondson in.
Yeah,
it's
completely.
Like, there's so many amazing people in it, but it's like, that's the guy.
And he's just wonderful. And, you know, people, because all my friends back home, they were so obsessed with Bottom and the Young Ones like I was. And they say, like, what was he like? Was he kind of funny in real life? I was like, not really, but at the same time, didn't try to be. And I found that really refreshing. That he's very, very comfortable in himself. And it goes back to that thing that we were talking about like, he has this thing where he filmed The Young Ones for however many weeks it was, like a very short amount of his life, but it's the thing that's constantly being talked about.
Yeah.
He's escaped that now. And when he meets people, he doesn't feel the need to meet their expectations of him.
He
knows that he's just a kind of very studious, very intelligent, quiet man who just lives his own life. And I think that seeing his comfort with the world is kind of inspiring in terms
that's beautiful, isn't it?
Somebody to be so closely connected to one thing and then just I want to be in things like Three Body Problem now and there's nothing you can do to stop me.
And that could be one of the biggest inspirations is seeing people that are on such a pedestal for you playing smaller parts in things.
Yeah.
I've had that a few times where I'm like, oh, wow, I've worked with actors who... are quite new in a small part, who feel quite indignant about how small their role is and how insignificant, how low that down there on a call sheet. And then you look across at an Aid Edmondson or someone who's also there, and they've not got, they're excited about the role, they're proud to be there, they're doing it right. And that's a massive inspiration. Anytime you're sitting there going, because I'm not one of the key people, I've had to wait on set for so long and we'll have to move this and move that. And like, you're looking over at, it puts the right perspective on it.
Oh, totally. It's like, I don't know if you've seen it, it's like Jesse Plemons in Civil War.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I have.
It's a bit blew me away. No spoilers, but he's not in that film as much as the trailer might suggest. In it.
Yeah.
But it's a bit like, you know.
If you're a Jesse Plemons fan, watch the trailer.
Watch the trailer.
That's his highlight reel. But he's amazing in it.
He's amazing. I came out of the cinema with my friend, and I think the phrase he used was, I've been Plemons fished. Completely Plemons fished. But then again, it's a bit like there was this part in that film, and they presented it to him. They thought he'd be the best person in the world to play it, and he was.
Yeah.
He just does it. And his influence and his presence permeates that entire film.
I love that. I love when kind of auteurs like Alex Garland, and you'd put Scorsese and people like that in there. They know that they can ask almost anyone to play almost any size role.
Well, Oppenheimer's the one.
Yeah,
I mean,
Oppenheimer, prime example. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, you're going to go, I'm up for it.
Yeah.
Regardless of what it is. Famously, Nolan apologising to Florence about the size of the role.
Yeah, and exactly. Like,
mate, I'm honoured to be on your set. This is insane. Because she'd blown up in between the kind of, approaching and all that.
And I think David and Dan, especially coming after... You know, when they were sort of trying to cast who they wanted to cast in Three Body Problem, the luxury of having their name now attracts, people to it. But
industry-wise as well, like, they're high on my list of people I want to work with just because of hearing you and Benny talk about them.
Yeah.
So credits aside, I genuinely think when people are nice people and a joy to work with, it resonates. I think it's a combination of those two, because there are also huge people that people aren't keen to work with because, it might make a lot of money, but fuck that.
Exactly
kind of
that.
Thing. Whereas I think they've got that perfect combination of everyone you talk to, speaks so highly of them as showrunners,
seeing a whole the thrill for me and Liam Cunningham and Conleth Hill and all the other Game of Thrones actors. I think there's five of us that were in the
see if
any of your listeners can name the five.
That's a great test.
To see a whole new cast of people fall in love with them,
like
that was a very intensive decade, but now people who've never met them before, actors that have come from all over the world again to be part of this thing, you hear them say, like, those guys are really awesome, aren't they?
Yeah.
I'd be like, yeah, they are awesome, yeah. But just seeing the way they coalesce a cast and crew together.
Yeah.
Something very special about that kind of quiet, authoritative, but very kind of approachable leadership. It's an amazing study.
It resonates and it goes on and on. Again, the beautiful thing is, there's going to be people from the Game of Thrones family who now go on and build this, make sure their sets are like that and their working environments are right. So I just love how that stuff goes on in the right way. Speaking of working with people and kind of little games, I've kind of got a bit of a challenge for you, because the whole kind of what's next is always an impossible question with actors, because either you don't know or you can't talk about it. It occurred to me, you've started to make a habit of working with award-winning, gorgeous icons and people with the surname Wilson. So, J-Lo and Owen Wilson in a rom-com.
Yeah.
Marry Me. Halle Berry and Patrick Wilson in sci-fi. So I've been trying to think. So I'm thinking you need to work with maybe Salma Hayek and Luke Wilson.
Yeah.
Would make sense. Eva Mendes and Rainn Wilson.
Yeah.
But then mixing it up, Brad Pitt and Rebel Wilson.
Yeah.
George Clooney and Ruth Wilson.
Well, I was going to say, even before that, Tom Hopper?
Yeah.
From he's gorgeous, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tom Hopper, I did Merlin with Tom Hopper and Richard Wilson.
There you go.
It really works.
A gorgeous icon and a Wilson. It seems to be the way it goes. But just looking at the genres you've played, kind of thing, from sci-fi to rom-com to period.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you'd like to do that is on your list?
Funnily enough, the thing that I haven't done, I mean, I was talking to my team about this recently because I've just written a screenplay, which is kind of doing the sort of rounds at the moment, and we're getting feedback on it. And it's very much quite gritty and quite real life and quite unglamorous and straightforward and real life as it's lived from the background that I came from.
Yeah.
And I just, when I was doing it, I just realized I've never done anything like that.
Yeah. It's weird, isn't it?
I tend to do these quite heightened things, whether they're sci-fi, whether they're a fantasy thing, or even like something like Marry Me, which was a rom-com set in the world of, you know, elite pop music.
Yeah,
that's a
yeah.
very heightened
yeah,
environment
course.
To be in. And you know, so the thing that the sort of sensibility that I have in terms of that brutal, left-leaning, compassionate, working-class, regional yeah. filmmaking
yeah.
or TV making. Something that's very much in my heart and something that is my artistic sensibility, and you can tell that because the first thing I ever wrote was about that.
Yeah.
It's just something that I've never really made contact with in my professional acting life.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because again, often, I don't know, you'd think almost the closest to home is the first things you'll get cast in because it's so familiar. But yeah, it's been the exact opposite so far.
It's been the exact opposite.
And so stretched.
In terms of bringing it sort of back down to earth. And, you know, if I was going to... Did you see the thing about Carolina Hearn over Christmas?
Yeah. Bloody hell. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Heartbreaking.
But in terms of the way she took elements that would be so routinely overlooked.
Yeah.
By people who make telly or people who commission telly.
Yeah.
So nothing happens. There's like four or five people talking and she knows exactly who each of those characters are and how they interact. And all the world is there. There's nothing more interesting than people. And I just think that everything that I've done, humanity plays a big part in it, but it has this umbrella concept over the top of it. Or, you know, there's a certain intellectual leap that the audience have to take. But just in terms of studies of people and really letting the acting shine and really letting the personalities shine, there's something that's kind of a bit of an itch that I need to scratch, I think.
Yeah.
Just doing something Shane Meadowsy or something Ken Loachy or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's all very part of my, you know, part of my palette, but it's just not been explored yet.
No, that's beautiful. And it sounds exciting. It makes me think of when Paddy...
Yeah.
Considine decided to go, I'm going to give directing a try.
Yeah.
And did Tyrannosaur. And
oh,
it's
yeah.
It's just one of the best things. And
then
Journeyman as well, which is just, and again, it's like, well, yeah, it's worlds that he knows. And
completely.
That you can connect to in that way. So is writing, how much is writing playing a part in your mindset of what is ahead and what is the future? Are you focused on what's the next acting job, or are you focused on, right, I've written the next acting job I want this to be, ideally?
It's an interesting thing about the writing element of it, because I can't remember, because I wrote it over a long time, I can't remember if it was deliberate or not, but I finished it and I just thought, oh, there's no part for me in this.
Mm.
And I wasn't going to crowbar one in. And I just thought, oh, it's a completely different muscle and I want it to be separate.
Yeah,
I kind of don't want to write to facilitate acting.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm kind of happy for it to be a different thing.
Yeah.
And I think I'm not confident enough in as a writer to commit to it seriously as a career.
Sure.
I think because I'm something else means that I'm more comfortable writing rather than staking everything on it.
Yeah, yeah.
As a handy sideline away from acting and just being a bit more creative and not necessarily relying on the phone to ring, but being the originator of an idea. That was the point of it.
Mate, I think it's amazing for sanity and anything anyone in this industry in particular can find to keep you busy. And I think specifically creatively.
Completely.
Because it is that thing that you've no control over when the phone is going to ring. And when you're... I've definitely had periods where I've had scripts in development where I'll suddenly realise, oh, I've not had an audition in 4 months, and I hadn't noticed because I'm so in this world.
Yeah.
Whereas if I wasn't, I'd be going, I haven't had any auditions in for a bit. Is there?
Yeah.
And looking at all the projects that are coming up and all this kind of thing. Whereas,
totally.
Yeah,
and just doing it for your own sense of fulfillment and Basically, you know, this is the first script that I've finished that's in decent shape and that I'd be kind of willing to show people. But me and my friend tried to write a film a couple of years ago. And the problem with that was we told people about it way too early. People were phoning up and saying, the development wing of my agent rang up and were like, have you got any ideas? And we'd been talking about it for a couple of weeks. And then we told them and they were a bit like, right, okay, great. We'll get you a meeting. We want you to write a pitch. We'll get you a meeting with these producers where you can pitch it. And ultimately, because we hadn't written anything before, we kind of crumbled because we didn't know how it worked. And it dragged on and on. And it sort of fell apart. So this time, the idea of telling people about it too early and crumbling again was just too humiliating to think of. So I wrote it completely in secret.
Brilliant.
Delivered it, finished. Writing it just for the sake of writing it. And then when I came to finish it, I thought, it's pretty good, this. I'm going to actually show people it. But that's like... all of it's the same what we were talking about before, the difference between writing when there's no pressure on and the difference between writing when there's pressure or creating when there's pressure on. Completely different attitudes.
Again, I think something else comes out, though, in the art as well. If you're writing for the sake of writing and for the sake of the art, and then it's the industry. Sometimes things have to be tweaked and changed and whatever else, but I think there's a beauty and purity in that. And I saw someone on Instagram posted today, and again, I guess it's about time and it's about when, because this industry is one where you do need to ask people fucking permission to do this get things signed off. But it just said, don't talk about your moves, announce your arrival.
Yeah.
And I really like that.
That's great.
So being able to go, I've got a script.
Yeah.
Rather than I've got a script idea and it's going to be this and I'm going to do that and that. Go, there you go, I've got a script. Now, who do we talk to? What do we need to put together for a pitch document?
Yeah.
How do we have to have the meetings? I think...
completely.
It's a really good kind of way of doing things. Because again, it wipes out... because again, you could have an idea and then, as said, you could fuck it up because it gets too good a response.
Yeah.
And then you've got all this doubt and imposter syndrome and panic of like, oh no, everyone's interested and I've not even written it. I don't know if I can.
Yeah, totally.
And that can be the thing that means you can't.
Exactly that.
Whereas if you've just done it, then...
yeah,
there you go. Here's what it is. It might not be right for everyone, but here's what it is. So,
but at least you're proving to yourself, as much as anything, that you can have an idea and execute it.
Yeah,
you can see it through, and it may make you, there's that thing about some people have. Everybody has ideas, but most people probably have ideas and then just forget about them.
Yeah,
because they've got to get the bus or they've got to do. But there's other people who just won't let an idea go.
Yep.
And they're the people who get stuff done.
Exactly. I've definitely, since I've known writers, and then again, since I've started writing, I've had numerous mates say, oh, I've got this great idea. Like, would your mate like to write it?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. It's like, no, they've got their own ideas.
Yeah, totally. Like,
everyone's got a great idea.
Yeah.
The difference is, as you say, the ones who do it and the ones who don't.
Yeah.
So
but just
get it on paper yourself.
Exactly. Like, and if you do it once, it just gives you the confidence to do it again.
My biggest regret was how long it took me to write my first script. I felt like a fucking idiot.
Because
I put it off and put it off and put it off.
Yeah.
And then when I wrote it and I was really pleased with it, I was like, oh, man.
Yeah.
I could have been doing this for years. I've been telling myself, oh, I need to learn more in this area. And there are things that you need to learn. But the things that my scripts have got hype for is because they've got my voice. So
completely.
I've learned the right bits, but it's not the perfect structure every time. It is going to have a little bit more about it. And that's fine. That's the character. That will get not worked out, but... any lack in structure will come in the process.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so...
completely. And I think that's why I think that if you are going to do it, you should definitely do it on your own first.
Yeah.
Because I think when I tried to write in collaboration with other people, if you don't know what your own process is, it's impossible to create a process between you that coalesces properly.
Yeah, yeah.
And since then, since I've able to get this screenplay finished in some form, I know what my process is now.
Yeah.
In terms of... I'd never go to the computer with a blank screen because I think it's intimidating. I basically wrote the entire script out in freehand.
Amazing.
Because that doesn't feel as intimidating.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels much more casual and the stakes of it feel lower.
Yeah.
But if you start with a blank screen and you're not quite sure what you're going to write or even how you're going to start, it just seems like a void that you're peering into.
I'm similar. My version of that was always stop early.
Right,
so
yeah.
That the next day I know where I'm starting, if you know what I mean.
Great.
Rather than get to the end of my idea, stop a chunk before. So, and again, I get a lot of insomnia, so I'm going to be going off on it anyway overnight.
Yeah.
So more will come, but at least I know in the morning I know which scene I have to finish up,
yeah,
or which scene I'm starting with.
That's
so
perfect,
again,
yeah,
always got that kind of,
yeah,
you know where you're starting rather than you sit down. And again, it might be you write that one scene, it takes you 10 minutes and then you're blank, but at least you've got you've got the ball rolling.
At least you've achieved something in that session. And I think that comes from going from one discipline that you're proficient and comfortable in,
mm-hmm,
into a different one.
Yeah.
Because
that you hope to be proficient and comfortable,
yeah, exactly,
at some point.
But for yourself as a you know, the spoken word stuff and the poetry stuff and me from acting, you know that you can rely on that.
Yeah.
Because you know what your method is and your process is for that, and it becomes like a thing that you can trust yourself to be able to pull off.
Yeah.
But when you go into something else, it all feels much more mysterious.
Yeah, exactly. And it can be so scary. I got a message the other day from Papa Essayadu, who I think is one of the best actors in the fucking world at the moment. And it came at just the right point, because I've got a few script projects that I've been hitting walls on, and you get a bit disheartened on. You have those moments of, this is the best script ever.
Yeah.
And then you have those moments of, what's the point?
Yeah.
And he sent me a message kind of out the blue, because he'd come to some of my spoken word shows back in the day and stuff like that. And it was just, I won't go into the details, but it was just a really nice message kind of saying that your voice is important.
Yeah.
Keep pushing through kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh yeah, it is.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, that's nice. Like, it's kind of to have someone you respect. And again, he probably won't even remember sending it, but it came at just the right point to make me go, fuck this. I need to get remotivated on this front and see your own value. Because again, you're completely right. Because you're starting in a new area, you think, and it's a working class thing, you think you're right down the bottom and you have no value. But everything that you've learned on every set, on every script you've read, you've worked with some of the best script writers in the history of TV. Everything you've learned there has gone into you.
Yeah.
You've taken parts from that. So you're not starting right down at the bottom. You're starting somewhere else. And it might not be at the top, but it's somewhere in the middle. But it's easy for us to think, oh, well, the script stuff's a new thing. And what you've learned of characters in acting.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all really important for going into scripts and for writing. So, it's easy to forget that these are really transferable experiences. I wouldn't even say skills. I'd say the experiences are really transferable. So,
Also, having different, you know, if you do have a voice that's worth listening to, you know, if you do have a little bit of belief in yourself, that can transcend. I mean, I started to write a thing recently about a medical thing that I'd had recently. And when I started to write it, I didn't know if it was going to be a book, or I didn't know if it was going to be an article, or was it going to be a treatment for a film or whatever. And as it's gone on, it's turned into, I think, what the best thing it could be is like a one-man show.
Yeah.
But that, I would never have sat down and gone, I'm going to write a one-man show about this. The idea, it just becomes quite obvious if you persist with an idea. It's like the idea is looking for a hole to drop into.
Yeah.
And it's dropped into the one-man show hole, and then that's an exciting thing. And you know what you're writing for.
That's beautiful to hear, man. And we'll talk a little bit when we wrap, but I really believe in projects existing in the world that they're meant to exist, if you know what I mean. That it's like you could have mentioned that idea to someone professionally and they could have pushed you, no, this has to be a TV series or this has to be a podcast or a book or whatever else.
Yeah.
And you might have been swayed on that and gone, all right, well, that's the way to go. But to find its natural place and go, no, this is what it's meant to be. Easy example I can say is this podcast, that when it started and when it got big, I'd have people asking if I'm going to do it as a TV show or if I'm going to get a Six Music show and everything else. I'm like, no, this is the thing.
Totally.
This is the thing. It's not to try and get to something else.
Yeah.
It's its own thing. And I think there's a beauty in that when you're creating, and it's hard when you're in the industry and been in the industry as long as you have, because you do start to think in the market and way things are and where this slots and what's best and what Netflix are looking for in this period and what's happening with cinema and so on and so forth. And it can be so important to shut all that off and go, how about the art? That sounds so pretentious, what does the art need?
Yeah.
What's important to this piece of art rather than how's the marketing, how's this, and what's the runtime have to be? And,
exactly right. Because if you take something like Fleabag or Baby Reindeer, they were both one-person shows that they did for a long time. And then if they would have pitched them as shows, or if they were TV shows from the first, you know, origination of the idea.
Yeah.
They may not be what they've become. They almost certainly wouldn't be what they've become. Because
chewing gum's another one. Completely.
Exactly. Great example, yeah. In terms of, you spend that much time with an idea if you do it, perform it every night for years sometimes.
Yeah.
That you really dig down into what your characters are and what story you're trying to tell, rather than if you can write it quickly and shoot it quickly, we can have it on by the end of the year.
Exactly.
It's not that expediency is not always the, you know, you wring the most out of it.
I completely agree, and again, it's beautiful to hear. But I'll wrap things up here, because I think we could ramble on for hours and hours on end, but I don't want to take up too much of your time. It's been a pleasure as ever, man.
Absolutely.
It's mad,
mate,
that we've done three of these and we've still got loads to talk about.
Absolutely.
I definitely have people every now and then who hit me up and I think, you've been on a few times. I don't know if we're going to have anything to say, but this was, to be clear, me actively hitting you up saying, dude, I need to talk to you about Three Body Problem.
Come back
because it's good. But it's been a pleasure and I'm excited for all that's ahead in whatever shape or form it may take.
Thank you, mate. Thanks for having me on. Like this always flies by so quick and doesn't feel like the great thing about it is you can forget that you're even what you're doing sometimes. It's like you were saying, this is a podcast format, but if you just make it feel like a chat, you forget about all that.
It's the whole point of it. It's why I don't film them still.
Yeah.
To this day, as film podcasts have gone through the roof, I could be wrong, but I still feel if we had a camera there, we'd be a little bit more performative.
Yeah.
And even when I'm doing them over Zoom, if I was recording that, you act different. But these feel more, this format feels more
The performativeness
intimate.
Can just come from self-consciousness most of the time.
Yeah, 100%.
And that makes you feel more scrutinised and shut. So this is, once again, you found the perfect format here for what you wanted to do and you've executed it.
Well, perfect, man. It's been a pleasure and we'll do it again soon, I'm sure.
I'd love to, mate. Absolutely.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was John Bradley. I hope you enjoyed that and I hope you agree. It was the best conversation that me and John have had. And the other two have been classics. I'll make no bones about it. The other two have been classics. So delighted to chat with John. And I'll be back next week. I'll be back next week to talk to you lovely, lovely people. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.